So the title of the talk, as advertised, was the development of Christian tradition from the end of the New Testament period to the first ecumenical council. Okay, so that's where I lost the brother this morning. And I've put it there as the intellectual development, which is the development of thought and how Christians thought about things. So let's first of all define our terms as we want to present them in this talk. So when is the end of the writing of the New Testament? About the year 100 AD. Okay, so Jesus is born a little bit before 0 AD, or if such a year existed. And he died around the year 30 AD. And so about 70 years after the death of Jesus, you have this, the period that we're beginning, that we're going to talk about. At the end of the first period of more or less intense activity of Christians, in particular in evangelizing. And then it goes on to the first ecumenical council, which took place in the year 325. So you're talking, we'd be talking tonight, more or less about a 225-year period in about 40 minutes. So we're going to concentrate on the first half of that, which is the 100s in general, and see what was happening. So when we think of the beginning of the church like that in that period, if I speak for myself, it often seems to me as if it's like a dream. You know, a dream that's in black and white, and you can sort of make out shadows and so on and so forth. This year is so obscure to us. Now, it shouldn't be that obscure for one reason, which is that our age is a very technologically advanced age, and so was theirs. And our age as well, people think a lot, or maybe not enough, but there's a good bit of thinking going on and a good bit of social change, and so was their era too. So the first thing I have on the handout there, just to give you an example of that, is a picture of the Pantheon in Rome, which was completed in the year 126 AD. So a little bit into our period, just after 100 AD. And to this day, it has the largest expanse of unreinforced concrete in the dome. So that's just to cause you to have a little bit of respect for these people of this era. Okay, that they weren't, that even though it was a long time ago, they weren't in any way unlearned or stupid or anything like that. They're actually technologically very advanced. They had no reinforced concrete like we do, so they couldn't build skyscrapers or great bridges. So they built some great bridges, right? And they didn't have electricity or nuclear power, so they're very different from us in those ways. But in other ways, they're very technologically advanced. And the other picture there is the aqueduct, which, of course, by our period, is the aqueducts into Rome are already have been running for 400 years. So this was old hat to the Romans. But they're still wonderful examples of engineering. So the point behind that is that Christianity was born into an era of very high civilization. And it's good for us to remember that. Often we speak of the primitive church, right? Well, the church was never really primitive. Okay, from the very beginning, it was a time of great developments and very smart people all around. Politically, it was, let us say, far ahead of where we are today. Okay, it was actually not just a united Europe, not just hopes for a united Europe the way we have today. Okay, it also, the Roman Empire spread very happily, with most people being very proud and very happy to be part of it, all the way down at in the year 117 at its maximum spread to the Persian Gulf. So from Scotland to the Persian Gulf, this united state. And the Christians of the time, and a little later, were very conscious of the providence that caused Christianity to be born into this era. So in many ways, Christianity was born into a great time. And as I was saying, that's very important for us to understand it, right? Because Christianity was never primitive in that sense. Somebody like St. Paul is a great writer and a great speaker. And you read his letter to the Romans, and you hear how he takes an argument, he attracts his audience, he twists it, he has them. Okay, he moves on, he attracts another audience, he twists it, he has them. Okay, he's an excellent orator, an excellent writer. Right, so St. Paul, highly, highly educated, knew exactly what he was doing in his writings, and we see this as well. Not St. Paul isn't yet the greatest writer in the New Testament. Okay, St. Luke, the letter to the Hebrews, have a level of Greek eloquence and elegance, right? That is far beyond what other writers would have had. So the Christian experience from the beginning includes a lot that's very sophisticated in its thought. Now, having said that, Christianity was still an unwelcome force. So were there many Christians in the year 100? We really don't know. Right? If you were a Christian in the year 100, would you be part of a small minority, okay, like we're used to today? Probably. And at the same time, the indications that we have very little in the way of evidence, but what evidence we do have suggests that Christianity was nonetheless very rapidly expanding. So a mere 35 years or so after the death of Jesus, there is the first great persecution in Rome. You'll know about it, the Emperor Nero, okay, who burnt Rome, and he blamed it on the Christians, and he slaughtered the Christians, including most famously St. Peter and St. Paul. And Nero, of course, as you know, used to eat grapes like this while Rome burnt. You'll all have seen the pictures, I'm sure. And a writer who's writing 60 years later, a historian by the name of Tacitus, says that there was a huge number of Christians put to death in that persecution. So now, we don't know what he means by a huge number, right? But at least he's saying that in Rome, so 600 or 700 miles away from Judea, 30 years after the death of Christ, Christianity was a big thing already, right? And just take a look there in the first quote there that you have. Now, this is by a man by the name of Pliny, who's very famous for writing letters. And one of his letters that he wrote was when he was governor of a province of Rome in the year 112 to the Emperor Trajan. And he says to this, "It is my practice, my lord, to refer to you all matters concerning which I am in doubt, for who can better give guidance to my hesitation or inform my ignorance?" And this is his problem. "I have never participated in trials of Christians. I therefore do not know what offences it is the practice to punish or investigate, and to what extent. And I have been not a little hesitant as to whether there should be any distinction on account of age, or no difference between the very young and the more mature, whether pardon is granted for repentance, or if a man has once been a Christian, it does him no good to have ceased to be one, whether the name itself, even without offences, or only the offences associated with the name, are to be punished." In other words, Pliny is saying that there's an official policy of persecution of Christians, but he doesn't really know why. Okay, nobody's really clear as to what the Christians are doing wrong. Right, and Pliny himself says that what he really punishes for the Christians for ultimately, including execution, is quite simply that they break the law, and they're obstinate in breaking the law. So as far as he's concerned, it's the law not to be a Christian, therefore you can't be a Christian. And if you are a Christian, it doesn't matter what you do, how good you are, you've broken the law, and therefore you're to be executed. But Pliny also says that the result of his persecution of the Christians is that their numbers have decreased. And he says that before that, a very interesting thing. He says that up until that persecution, the temples were nearly deserted. Okay, so all the pagan temples out in the cities and the countryside were nearly deserted. And he says now people are going back to them. Okay, in other words, what the impression you get here is that Christianity was having a huge success. Right, and that a lot of people wanted to become Christians. And then they get persecuted, and a lot of them would give up, okay, naturally enough. But this and Tacitus too give us the impression that Christianity was a very rapidly expanding thing and very vibrant in that. So that's your Christians at the beginning of the second century. Okay, that they belong to a persecuted and yet a very vibrant and minority, something that has the paradox of having the suspicion of people, and yet people, in a sense, love it, that they want to be Christians too, and that they're attracted towards it. And the government is against it, and at the same time doesn't know why it is against it. Now, over this period of from 100 AD to 325 AD, we see changes in the church. Now, one thing we don't see changes in, and this is worth noticing, is in the liturgy. Okay, so we already have writings, in particular one writing. Well, we have the New Testament, first of all, where St. Paul, in the first letter to the Corinthians, speaks about the Eucharist, and he speaks about the Christians participating in the Eucharist. And we have another famous document discovered only in the 19th century called the Didache. Anybody here studying Greek? Yes. No, keep your hands down. Because Didache means teaching, okay, so it quite simply means the teaching of the 12 apostles. And it gives a very short document, but it gives a rundown of the Christian life, including the Eucharist, and it speaks about the Eucharist. And this Didache is written, people think, between the year 50 and the year 120, so a wide range, but certainly probably in the first century. And it speaks about the liturgy. And we come across this again, a man by the name of Justin Martyr, who we'll speak about quite a bit later on, speaks about it. And at the end of the 300s, they speak about it as well, and they're using the liturgy. I just want to read that same letter from Pliny. Speaks about this. When he's writing to the emperor, I don't think I have the quote on the page, but he says this, that the Christians asserted, however, that the sum and substance of their fault or error, okay, so Pliny is speaking about the error of the Christians, why he's putting them to death, why he's persecuting them. He says that they say that the only thing they do wrong is that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and sing a hymn to Christ as to a God. Sing a hymn to Christ as to a God. So a fixed day, which presumably is Sunday. And sing a hymn to Christ as God, and to bind themselves by oath, not to do some crime, but not to commit fraud, theft or adultery, not falsify their trust, nor to refuse to return a trust when called upon. When this was over, it was their custom to depart and to assemble again to partake of food, but ordinary and innocent food. Okay, so the idea of this Christian meeting where they eat and where they sing hymns as well. Okay, and he says it's ordinary and innocent food. Okay, so of course the word gets out, Christians are eating a body. All right? And the Romans say, who the hell are these people? Okay, so Pliny says that the Romans are protesting that it's ordinary and innocent food. Okay, it's only as far as you're concerned, it's bread and wine. All right? And it goes on then, Justin, 50 years later, or at least not 50 years later, but 40 years after Pliny, will write about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist in terms that we'll pass over, but there it is. Okay, so that's one thing that doesn't develop, right? The worship of the church seems to be very constant over this period from 100 to 325. So what causes the change? The changes are three. First of all, Christianity changes from being a Jewish religion, okay, expressed in terms of Judaism with words like Messiah and Christ, okay, and Son of Man, right, things that meant nothing to the Greeks and the Romans that it was expanding among, to being a Greco-Roman religion, okay, with words like substance and logos and things like that we'll come across later on. So that's the first thing. Christianity meets the philosophical background of the empire, right, as wherever it is. And this happens, two things happen out of this. One is that Christians begin to express their faith in the language of the empire. Okay, it's no longer, as I say, a Jewish religion. The other thing is that some people who are ordinary Greek or Romans, citizens of the Roman Empire, whatever culture, but a Greek sort of overlay in their education, they pick up bits of Christianity. And so they form a different Christianity, right? Which is partly pagan and partly Christian. Right? And then you get the great Christian writers and they fight against this. So these are called heresies, right? Which is a very unfashionable word today. Nonetheless, they are. Right? So we don't call anybody a heretic today except maybe after a few drinks or something like that. Right? Whereas those who were heretics 1,700 years ago, we called them heretics happily because nobody's like that today. More or less, you'll see there certain characteristics that remain the same. Secondly is, yes, and a very beautiful thing that happens over this time is that quite naturally the Christians who are thinking about their religion are realizing that the death and resurrection of Christ and the fact that God has become man in Christ has a significance for them that goes way beyond the simple idea of salvation. Okay, so in the scriptures you'll get seeds of this, you'll get little bits about Christianity being much more than salvation. Okay, especially in St. Paul's letter to the Romans, look at chapter 8, for example. But over these centuries, it expands. And you get writers, the great writers, will be thinking about this, and they'll be showing how Christianity is really something that takes up our whole lives. And the death and resurrection of Christ is something that is present to us all the time, and not simply in the issue of life and death. And the third way, then, in which Christianity develops, and there's a difference at the beginning and the end, is that you get a solidification of of this whole idea of who has authority in the church. And this has two little prongs to it, one of which is the development of the scriptures. Okay, so at the beginning of this period, about the year 100, you already have the New Testament. Okay, but it's sort of scattered writings, right? And at the end of this period, you have them together, and they're very confident that these are our scriptures and nothing else. And the second thing then is the authority of the church herself, and in particular of the bishops, and most particularly of the Church of Rome over the other churches too. So let's just take a look at that. I want to begin with a random text from the New Testament that speaks of Jesus. Right, you could pick lots of them, but just this is one of them, and it's from 1 Corinthians 8, 5, chapter 8, verses 5 to 6. And it goes like this. Did I quote that? I didn't. St. Paul says, he's writing to the Corinthians, and he says, "For although there may be many so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is only one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist." Okay, so St. Paul is saying to the Corinthians, well, there are many gods and many lords. We just look at all the pagan temples in this city alone. In Corinth alone, we see many gods, who are the Greeks and Romans, and many lords, who are the Eastern mystery gods that are there. But he says, for us, there's only one God and one Lord. Now, when I read that, it looks to me as if St. Paul is putting Jesus as Lord and the Father as God on the same plane. But I couldn't prove it. Okay, so what does St. Paul mean there in saying that there is one God and one Lord? What's his thought about Jesus? And this is something that gets worked out over the centuries in many ways. Now, what does this mean as well to someone who is a Greek or a Roman and who meets this saying of St. Paul that Jesus is Lord? What does it mean to say that Jesus is Lord? Okay, it's not perfectly clear from the beginning. And one of the things that's good for us to remember is that the Bible is already philosophical. Okay, so from the last few centuries of the Bible, they began to express the Bible in Greek terms, right, in terms of Greek philosophy. Now, this might horrify us to think that what does our religion have to do with all this esoteric stuff from Greece? But for example, when God appeared to Moses in the burning bush and Moses said, "What is your name?" Right? You'll know yourself that God said to him, "I am who I am," okay, which is our translation of a Hebrew term that's quite difficult to translate. Okay? Now, when the Jews in Alexandria translated that into Greek in about the year 270 or so BC, okay, 270 years before the birth of Christ, they translated it according to a term that's used in Plato for God. Imagine that. So is anybody here studying philosophy and studying Plato? Okay, you'll know that God is the really real in Plato. Okay, that everything else is more or less shadow, and God is the really real. He is ta'anontos, okay, the one that is the being that is really being, or the being, you could say. Right? Do you all get that? Yes. Okay. And the book of Exodus, when it translates that term from God into Greek, into the standard Greek translation that was used in synagogues right across the Middle East, it uses the masculine form of that. Right, so it's very interesting how the Bible is already turning Greek centuries before the birth of Christ. And when the Christians then meet Greek culture and Greek philosophy, of course this goes into, this takes on a whole new importance. And what happens as well to say that that God has become man in Christ? Right? This is the big problem that the Christians will face in understanding their faith. Because Plato quite rightly said that God is unchanging, right? That God is already perfect, okay? And he is absolutely perfect, dynamically perfect, and therefore he will never change, okay? So he's unchanging. And not only Plato, but also the letter of James in the Bible already says this, okay? In James 1:17, "Every good endowment and every perfect gift is from above," says St. James, "coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." That even though God creates all things, he himself never changes. So how do you understand then the fact that God became man? Right, that's question number one. Second question that faced the Christians at this time was, spiritual life is much better than the material life. Okay? In other words, something that thinks is higher than something that doesn't think. Okay? Clear example of that. You are better than your dog. Okay? You might not think your friend is better than your dog. Okay? But you yourself are conscious of being better than your dog because you think, and your dog only goes, right? And doesn't really think at all. Okay? So take this extrapolated into a very highfalutin philosophy, and you get the idea that the spiritual world is better than the fleshly world. And if God is so perfect, if he is unchangingly perfect, unchangingly good, well, what on earth is he doing in a human body? Okay? And this is still the question today for Islam. Okay? So you meet a Muslim and he'll say to you, I'm very sorry, but there's absolutely no way that God could become human and get sick and have a cold and blow his nose and go to the toilet. Okay? God is just above all those things. Right? And this is very much the question for the Christians too when they meet Greek philosophy and their fellow citizens of the Roman Empire when they meet Christianity. So these two questions, how can God change? And how can God become a man? And so the first problem that the Christians face when they meet the Roman Empire is what is called docetism. Okay, now there's no need to learn that off, right? But it means essentially the idea that Jesus only seemed to be a man, right? And this becomes very common. And you already see it towards the end of the writing of the New Testament. The first letter of John says that this is Antichrist, the one who denies that Jesus has come in the flesh. In the flesh. Okay, so it's interesting. We have this idea from Dan Brown. You've heard of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, that the Christians made Jesus into a god in the 300s. Okay? In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Right? That when the Christians first had a problem of Jesus being God and man, they held on to the idea that he was God, and they denied that he was man. That was what they denied. Okay, so that's what Docetism is, as the first heresy that we come across. And we already see it there. And we see it then in a wonderful man at the beginning of the second century. Okay, so I just want you to look at figure four there. And it's a picture from the Irish Dominican Church in Rome, I'll have you know, of St. Ignatius of Antioch, who was buried in that church. And St. Ignatius of Antioch was Bishop of Antioch, which at that stage, today Antioch is a very minor city in Turkey, on the border with Syria, but at that stage was the third biggest city in the Roman Empire, and it was the major center of Christians too. And Ignatius was bishop there, and he was, in the year 107, condemned to be thrown to the lions in Rome. And as he goes along, he writes these letters to the churches as he passes by. So he's got seven letters that are extant that he wrote to the churches. And just to give an idea of what type of person he is, just look at quote number three there. He writes to the Romans. Now the Romans, of course, are the great people for bribes, right? You can get anything done in Rome if you got a bribe. All right, hope there are no Italians here, no offense meant. And he says to them that it's very important for them that they do not bribe the officials to have him saved from being thrown to the lions. Okay, he wants to be thrown to the lions. Right? Now, this might sound ridiculous for you. Imagine what it sounded ridiculous for the Romans. Okay, because the Romans knew much better than we do how awful it was to be thrown to the lions. And he says to you, I beseech of you not to show an unseasonable goodwill towards me. Allow me to become food for the wild beasts, through whose instrumentality it will be granted me to attain to God. I am the wheat of God, and let me be ground by the teeth of the wild beasts, that I may be found pure bread of Christ. Rather entice the wild beasts, that they may become my tomb, and may leave nothing of my body, so that when I have fallen asleep in death, I may be no trouble to anyone. Okay, and so on and so forth. Okay, now, what's important for St. Ignatius, what we also see in his writings, is not only a desire to be thrown to the lions, as if he is suicidal, okay, he's not suicidal at all, but he sees something in his own life as a Christian, which most of the Christians haven't seen. And that is that the death and resurrection of Christ And the whole life of Christ has now become my life. Right? And that's essentially what St. Ignatius sees, that people haven't, which is of course already there in St. John and St. Paul in the scriptures, but people haven't really picked up yet. And St. Ignatius is the one who puts this front stage, that the life and death of Christ have become my life. And therefore he says that now that he's been condemned to the lions, this is great. Okay, because he is now imitating perfectly the life of Christ. And he speaks about the Eucharist, okay? He speaks about hoping to become that fine wheat, to become the bread of Christ, right? So Christ himself gives his life to us in the Eucharist. And therefore, my life is taken over by Christ as well. And my job as a Christian, my life as a Christian is to imitate Christ in every way. This is St. Ignatius's great addition to the thought of the Church, and why he's such a wonderful man, and why this period is a wonderful period of expansion of Christian thought. Now, what St. Ignatius also realizes is that if Christ didn't really become human, okay, if he only seemed to become human, then it's all useless. It's all useless. He has absolutely no effect on my life whatsoever, because I'm human. And if Christ only seemed to die, seemed to rise from the dead, then he's irrelevant to me. Okay, he might have done some nice things and said nice things, but he's irrelevant to me. Okay, so quote number 4 there in his letter to the Trallians as he passes by. He says, "Stop your ears, therefore, when anyone speaks to you at variance with Jesus Christ, who was descended from David and was also of Mary." Okay, in other words, he had human ancestry as well as from God, "who was truly born and ate and drank." Okay, not just seemed to be born. "He was truly persecuted under Pontius Pilate. He was truly crucified and died in the sight of beings in heaven and on earth and under the earth. He was also truly raised from the dead. His Father giving him life, even as after the same manner his Father will so raise up us who believe in him." Okay, so not only was Christ truly human, in a sense that makes him relevant to us, but his life will become ours. His resurrection will become ours. So he goes on there then in verse 10, "But if, as some that are without God, that is the unbelieving, say that he only seemed to suffer, they themselves only seeming to exist," he says, ha ha ha, "then why am I in bonds?" Okay, why am I being taken to Rome? "Why do I long to be exposed to the wild beasts? Do I therefore die in vain? Am I not then guilty of falsehood against the Lord?" So this is the first great addition, you might say, to Christian thought after the New Testament, is St. Ignatius. The realization that, and the expression that, my life is Christ, and Christ's life becomes mine too, and that everything I do as a Christian, because Christ is in me, has a relevance to eternity, you could say, and to the life of Christ. So that's the first great writer there. Three things so about Ignatius. One is that he's reacting against those who say that Jesus only seemed to be man but was truly God. Second is that he has this wonderful insight that everything about the life of Christ has now invaded my life. And my life is transformed, my death is transformed by the fact that I am a Christian. Okay? And thirdly then, this importance, obviously, of the fact that Christ truly was human. Okay, and we'll see this becoming important as time goes on. Second great figure then, who writes about this time, I'm moving on here, and I have no quote from him. So you're just going to have to sit up and listen, is a man by the name of Justin Martyr. Now, as you can imagine from a name like Justin Martyr, he didn't have a very happy end in the end. Right? Or maybe he did, as you say. Now, Justin's a very important person as well. So there are a few of you here who are studying theology and world religions and so on and so forth. And you come to university to study the Christian faith. Right? And at the root of all that is Justin. Right, so Justin was a philosopher, and like many others in his culture, which was very strongly philosophical, as we see from the New Testament itself, Justin studied philosophy, and he wanted to pursue the truth. And he went through various schools of philosophy. He went through the Stoics, first of all, one of the great, probably the most present, most popular school of philosophy at the time. And eventually he ended up as a follower of Plato, pure and simple. And he found that satisfying to an extent. And then he met a Christian. As far as I know, I didn't check this up, but according to the legend, he was a fisherman or something like that. Or at least he met him on a beach anyway, for sure. right? And the Christian persuaded him there and then that the true philosophy is Christianity. So Justin isn't really reacting to a heresy like Ignatius does, but what he wants to do is he wants to take Greek philosophy, and he says that everything the Greeks have been looking for is fulfilled in Christianity. Christianity is the true philosophy, and insofar as the philosophers of old were good, then their goodness is caught up and fulfilled in the teaching and the life of Jesus and the belief of the Christians. Now, once again, this is already there in the New Testament. Okay, so you have quote number 5 there. St. Paul in Acts of the Apostles, he goes along to Athens. And when he goes to Athens, which is, of course, the great center of philosophy, he goes up to the Areopagus. So maybe some of you have been there. I never have myself, I'm afraid. But it's the place where the philosophers were, especially Socrates, who was the great philosopher of history. And he starts to discuss with them in purely philosophical terms about God. And he says, "For as I passed along," he's speaking to the philosophers, "and observed the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by men, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything." Okay, all the Greeks would be all very happy with this. "Since he himself gives to all men life and breath and everything, and he made from one nation, every nation of men to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him. Yet he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." Okay? And what's also there in quote 6, is a very interesting quote. John 10, right? John 10 is this the chapter of the Good Shepherd. Jesus says, "I am the Good Shepherd." And then the story changes to this very little interesting snippet where it says it was the feast of the dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. I just have the Greek words there. Okay, so he is periepate, walking. He was walking in the temple in the portico, the store of Solomon. Now, both of these terms are associated with Aristotle, believe it or not. Right? So Aristotle's followers are called the peripatetics, because they used to walk up and down while they're doing their philosophy. Okay, in the store, in the portico in Athens. Okay, so it's as if Jesus or St. John, with a smile on his face, throws in a little bomb into his otherwise very Jewish gospel of Jesus as Aristotle. Okay, Jesus as the philosopher who's walking up and down. And of course, what portico is this? It's the portico of Solomon, the king of wisdom. Right? Philosophy being the love of wisdom as well. Right, so Justin, in this sense, is doing something very legitimate. It's already there in the New Testament. And what he also does in the New Testament is he takes up the idea of the Logos. So you'll all be familiar with this line, I hope, from the opening lines of St. John's Gospel. "In the beginning was the Word." Right, and if I ask you what the Greek for word is, those of you who are studying philosophy and theology will say, the word for word is Logos. Okay, and this means more than word in Greek. It also means reason, okay, and a thing as well, but we wouldn't even worry about that. Right, so Jesus is reason in that sense. And what's interesting about this in St. John's Gospel is that St. John introduces this idea. Then he paints the whole idea of the word as the Old Testament version of wisdom, and then he drops it. Right, so it's there in the opening verses of St. John's Gospel, and then he drops it. Right? Interesting why he started with that when he wasn't going to develop it. But St. Justin develops it. Okay, and he speaks about Jesus as being the reason behind the world. Right? And that's a very important concept for all of us. Any engineers here? Civil engineers? So civil engineers need to know that the world has reason. Okay, and they use their own brains to look at the reason of the world. Right? What's the gravity? What's the drop? What's the support? Okay, and they calculate all these things. What's the strength of this concrete? Okay, and they're doing mathematics all the time. And that is because the world itself, materials, have reason in them, and the human mind accesses that reason. Right? And this is the way. So that's a very easy example, I hope, of the fact that the world is permeated by reason. Right? You get out of bed in the morning, right? You expect the floor to be there. All right? And that's reasonable. Right, we walk along the things, and things are where they are. Okay, the sun rises, sun sets, and so on and so forth. And the whole world is permeated with order and reason. And Justin is saying, where does this come from? Now, the Greeks, for many centuries before, had the idea of logos, of reason, as permeating the world. And this goes back way, way, way back, before Plato, this idea that the world is reasonable. So Heraclitus, for example, if you haven't studied philosophy, don't worry about it. But Heraclitus had the idea that things are always changing. Right? His famous phrase that you can't put your hand into the same river twice. Okay, that the river has changed by the time you've taken your hand out and put it back in again. But he says when it changes according to logos. It changes according to reason. So things are always changing around us, and yet according to a pattern. Right? So this is centuries before the Jesus. Okay, but it comes down right through Greek philosophy, and Justin says this logos is Jesus, that Jesus is the Word. Okay, so he's got a very high idea of Jesus and a very high idea of creation too, which is derived from the opening lines of St. John's Gospel. Right, and what does that mean? A little bit like saying that Ignatius of Antioch, who was thrown to the lions, realized that Jesus and his death and resurrection permeates our whole lives. That his death, his resurrection, his life changes our lives, changes our deaths. That Justin then, for his part, realized that Jesus, as the Word of the Father, permeates the whole of creation. That all of creation can see traces of Jesus in it. So where would you see traces of Jesus in ordinary creation? Okay, first of all, in reason, that things make sense. Okay, that he's the Logos, in its beauty. Okay, that God is beautiful and creation is beautiful too. Okay, at least when we leave it alone, and so on and so forth. And the very fact that it exists, okay, is another thing in which we see logos or Jesus or God in creation. Okay, so that's true of the great writers. And as you can see, I suppose what my theme is here is that Christianity is expanding. Right, the people are taking the scriptures and they're realizing that it's got a message for us well beyond what we might have thought simply by reading the Bible. Now, I'm over time from now on, but I'm still going to take another 5 minutes just to very rapidly run through something. As Christianity meets with Greek religion, or sorry, meets with Greek philosophy, there's something very positive about that, and there's something very negative too, okay? Because a lot of paganism comes into Christianity. And you get, in fact, two versions of Christianity growing up, okay? One of which is what we would take today called Orthodox Christianity, and the other is called Gnosticism, okay? Which is from the Greek word meaning knowledge, gnosis, okay? So Gnosticism begins with a G, by the way, right? G-N-O-S-T, etc. And one major writer on Christ and on this era says that they were like twins. Okay, so what we think of today as Christianity was not the only Christianity at the time. Okay, in the first century it was. Right, but in the second century something else grows up alongside it. And this is Gnosticism. And Gnosticism has certain characteristics. First of all, it's based on the idea of knowledge. Okay, so salvation in that sense isn't open to everyone. Right, so for Christianity is good news for the poor. Right, you don't have to be smart to be a good Christian, whereas to be a good Gnostic you do. Okay, because you have to develop your spiritual side. Right, so you'll come across many people who say, "I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual." Okay, now this is not Gnosticism. Right, you needn't point fingers at them, but it's got something to do with it. Okay, the idea that I have developed my spiritual side to a degree better than most people. And the other thing about Gnosticism is that it hates the idea of the flesh, right? So once again, it's the idea of the spiritual, that the spiritual is the important side, but my body is not, right? Whereas for Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, the body is very important, okay? Because Christ rose from the dead, and we're all going to rise from the dead on the last day. So we're not going to live without our bodies. And into this reaction to Gnosticism comes a man whose name is Irenaeus. And Irenaeus comes from the far east, from Turkey, what is today Turkey, but he migrates via Rome to the city of Lyon in France. Okay, and you see there, figures 5 and 6 is the church of St. Irenaeus in Lyon, and the Roman amphitheatre in Lyon, where he was probably put to death in the year 202. And Irenaeus is very important because he takes on Gnosticism, but in the meantime, in taking on Gnosticism, he builds a whole vision of Christianity that is very, very complete in itself. And I just have two quotes there that bring out, of all the writings that Irenaeus did, he had a major work called Against the Heresies, just two quotes there that give us a taste of what he's at. Right, so in the first quote there, you'll see what's in bold. It says, "For the glory of God is a living man, and the life of man consists in beholding God." Okay, so if the Gnostics were saying that the glory of a man is in his own knowledge, in his own mind, okay, for Irenaeus, it's been living. It's a living man in all sorts of ways. That God himself finds his glory not in us developing our divine spark and going up to God, but in we ourselves. We ourselves are the glory of God. The more we live, the more we reflect the glory of God. And ultimately, the life of man consists in beholding God, in seeing God. And the second one there, he says, "But following the only true and steadfast teacher," okay, so he's telling to reject heresies. He says, "But on the contrary, following the only true and steadfast teacher, the word of God, our Lord Jesus Christ, who did through his transcendent love become what we are, that he might bring us to be even what he is himself." Okay, in other words, he's saying that Jesus became man so that we could become God. Okay, not God in the sense of the Buddhist idea of God, but God in sharing the life of God in immortality and eternal happiness. Right, so a very exalted idea of the Christian vocation. Right, which once again is already there in the scriptures. In one line at least, St. Peter speaks about partaking in the divine life. But here it is in Irenaeus as a great theme that and that really is a revolution in Christianity to have it expressed so well. Right, that Christ became man so that we could become God. We could share in the life of God in that way. While not, of course, becoming God or losing our individuality. Now, Irenaeus does two other things of great importance that I just want to mention as well. Or at least one thing that happens around Irenaeus is that you get, for the first time, the development of the New Testament as sacred books. Now, Irenaeus isn't the one who does this, but the Gnostics, in a sense, cause it. So you might just turn to page 4 there. I show you there a picture of the National Geographic from 2004. And what it's got on the front cover is a book called The Judas Gospel, which had actually discovered in the 1970s, was sort of hidden as people looked into it. And then in 2004, it was published as to its importance. Okay, and it was very important as an archaeological find. But people said at the time, well, this is going to revolutionize our picture of Jesus. Right, and the Gospel of Judas essentially is what we call a Gnostic Gospel. Okay, so it has a picture of Judas. That Judas was the favorite disciple, okay, and that Jesus asked him to betray him so that Jesus himself could be killed and in being killed could escape out of his flesh, out of his body. Because, of course, the Gnostics hate the body, right? And it's the spirit is to be released. Okay, now, what's important to remember about this is that it wasn't going to change our picture of Jesus. Okay, first of all, because we already knew there was such a thing as the Gospel of Jesus, Gospel of Judas. Right, so Irenaeus himself mentions it in his writings. Secondly, because we know very well that there are all sorts of books about Jesus in the second century that the church didn't include in the New Testament. Okay, so if this caused such an outcry, you could say, in 2004, imagine what it caused in the second century. Right, so what you see in the second century then is that the church makes up a list. Certain books are in, certain books are out. Okay, and this is what is called the canon of scripture. And essentially what makes this really happen is, it's there in quote 13, but I'm not going to take time to read it, is that there's a priest by the name of Marcion. Oh no, it's not 13, that's sorry. But there's a priest by the name of Marcion who, in Rome, about the year 140, chops up the Bible and makes a new Bible, a new Testament, according to his own wishes. And the church excommunicates him. Okay, says, right, so the church has never really, or the Church of Rome has never said anything about the New Testament writings. Now all of a sudden it's saying, well, we're not going to believe that anyway. Okay, and this is what you get, the first development of the New Testament scriptures. Right, important point for us, is that the church and the Bible go together. Right? Because it's in this time that the Bible is formed as a collection of books. Right? And it's from the Church of Rome, essentially, that we see any evidence at all of this happening. Okay, but it happens around this time. So around this time as well, you get the first collections of the writings of St. Paul. And here's a question. Where are the first collections of the writings of St. Paul today? What city has the best collections of the early writings of St. Paul? Okay, they're about 1 mile away from us here, okay, in the Chester Beatty Library, right? One of the two great collections of early Christian writings in the church. Bet you didn't know that. I hope some of you did. Okay, and the other thing that Irenaeus does, and it's very, very important for us to understand, to look back, is that he's asking not only what is the authority that decides between Gnosticism and Orthodox Christianity, and it's the Bible, okay, so he argues from reason, he argues from the Bible, but he also argues from authority, and he speaks about the churches, and he says, you look at the churches that are apostolic, you look at the bishops, and none of them follow Gnosticism. And then he says something there, that's quote 13 there this time. He says, since, however, it would be very tedious in such a volume as this to reckon up the successions of all the churches, we do put to confusion all those who, in whatever manner, whether by an evil self-pleasing, by vainglory, or by blindness and perverse opinion, assemble in unauthorized meetings by indicating that tradition derived from the apostles of the very great, the very ancient, and universally known church founded and organized at Rome by the two most glorious apostles, Peter and Paul. Okay, so Saint Irenaeus, in that sense, gives us a great sense of the importance of the bishops, and most especially of the Bishop of Rome. Right, so a very modern question here, right? And Saint Irenaeus is already dealing with it. Now, this isn't the first time, of course. Clement of Rome, as in, if you read that quote downwards, you'll see that Clement of Rome at the end of the first century had already written to Corinth, and Corinth didn't say, "Mind your own business. We don't want to hear what Rome has to say." On the contrary, Corinth accepted what he had to say. Okay, so I haven't at all done what we were meant to do to get to 325, but we have got more or less to about the year 200. Okay, and I'd just like to really say that what we've seen here, and I think is very important, very beautiful in the church, is how the church dealt with its culture at the time, okay, by engaging it in that sense, engaging it with a full mind, and how, with these great writers, it expanded its faith. So as to really realize how Jesus is so powerful in our lives. Okay, that they took the data that was already there in the scriptures, in Paul and John, and they expanded it. Okay, so just one last thing, it'll only take me 60 seconds, is that to skip 100 years, by the year 313, the church was legal. Okay, the emperor didn't become Christian, but he legalized Christianity, and he became Christian on his deathbed, Emperor Constantine. And at this time, there's a great dispute, which is Jesus a created thing? Okay, is the Son of God created, or is he one with the Father in some sense? Okay, and a man by the name of Arius says that he is a created thing, that he is still greater than all the other creatures and so on and so forth, but still created. And in 325, there's this council that meets to discuss the question because it's dividing Christianity, and it comes out with the creed that we say every Sunday. Okay, and there are two very important terms in this creed, just to skip over and come to the very end without having developed it at all. That it says that Jesus is God from God, light from light. Now, Arius wouldn't have minded that, okay, because what's a God? You know, is he the great God or a little God or whatever? Right, so he wouldn't have minded that. But then it says, true God from true God. And that's a statement that is absolutely uncompromising in the divinity of Jesus. And then it says another thing, that he was begotten, not made. And then that word, consubstantial with the Father. Okay, that he is one thing, one being with the Father, even though a different person. And that is really brings us, so this era then, you could say, brings us to our own picture of Jesus that we have today, that we recite every Sunday in the Creed, that he is the true God, and that he is consubstantial with the Father, and that he fills our whole lives in that sense, in the way that the martyrs and the writers of the first two centuries have taught us. So, I'm over time there. Apologies to anybody who's got itchy feet. If anybody would like any questions, I'd be delighted to pass them on to somebody who knows what he's talking about. But in the meantime, I'll feel them myself. Great.
Would you all take questions sitting down or standing up, or do you prefer?
I'll take them. Yeah. I'll be fine here. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Father Terence, for that very interesting talk. Functioned very well, even 1500 years into 50 minutes, and also for some very interesting church trivia. And so we have about 10 minutes or so for questions. So does anyone have any questions? Anyone at all?
I'd be delighted to get questions to hear what you're interested in.
No, even our theology students. No.
I'm thinking about it.
Can you speak more about to what extent early Old Testament writers would have incorporated Greek philosophy into their accounts and their translations?
Okay. In their translations, I can't really. Okay. Are you studying philosophy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what might interest you is, and I every plan to write an article on this myself, but I haven't, is that the story of Noah and his ark, okay, is quite an interesting story, because even though it's written in Hebrew, when it gets translated into Greek, it begins to sound desperately like the idea of nous. Okay, so you can already see the two names, Noah. Okay, in Greek becomes Noe, in the genitive sometimes Noes. Okay, and then so nous is your, okay, we sometimes use that. Have you got any nous whatsoever, right? Nous is your own reason, right? And so that forms an easy one. And Plato also has a picture of nous as the pilot of a ship, right? So that's one that feeds very easily from one version to the other. Now that's, so they're really the only two examples I know in terms of translation, right? But what you do see is, of course, towards the early Old Testament has what's it interested in? It's interested basically in Israel, okay? That Israel has the land, right? It has its kings. And if it follows God, it's happy. And if it's not, it's not. Okay, and then it clashes with the exile in Babylon. And that becomes the great issue, right? Is God going to save it from exile, save it from the kings that are ruling it, and so on and so forth. But towards the end of the Old Testament period, coming up in the last few centuries before Christ, you get a whole different type of questions, which are called the wisdom literature, right? And there'd be books like the Book of Job would be a classic one, the Book of Wisdom, the Book of Sirach, the Book of Ecclesiastes, or sometimes called Koheleth. Okay, there'd be the four big ones. And they're not interested in land. Okay, they're not interested in exile, they're not interested in anything at all. They're interested in how do you live? And what sense does life make? Okay, so the Book of Job is all about the man who suffers even though he's innocent. And what's suffering got to do with a God who's good? But if God loves Israel and if God rewards those who are good, what on earth are good people doing suffering? Okay, so it's very much a philosophical question in that sense. And you could see this too in the Book of Proverbs. And Proverbs and wisdom in this sense are similar, that they deal with the question of wisdom. Okay, so Proverbs is to a large extent about the younger generation learning from the older ones. Sorry about that, folks, but it is. Okay, and the wisdom of the father and so on and so forth being passed on to the children. Right, but in a sense it's trying to give a Hebrew version of what the Greeks are doing as well. Okay, how to live wisely. Right, and wisdom is the same. The Book of Wisdom is the same then, because the Book of Wisdom is written in Alexandria, almost just before the birth of Christ. It's the latest of the Old Testament books. And its line really is that, don't go following those pagans. Okay, our wisdom is much greater than theirs. Right, that we have the law, and that's the real wisdom. Okay, and then Koheleth as well, as you know, the Book of Ecclesiastes, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Okay, what sense does life make? Right, a year comes, a year goes, next year won't be remembered in 10 years' time, and so on and so forth. What point is it? Right, so it's very much a philosophical text in that way. So in these ways, you can see that because Israel and Greece, of course, are very close to each other, right? And with Alexander, then Alexander the Great conquering all that region, they're under Greek rule for most of the next 300 years or so. Okay. So in that sense, you can see they're influenced by the Greeks, and they're taking up Greek themes, sometimes treating them like the Greeks, sometimes very differently.
So, any other questions? I think Platonism would be like the greatest of all the Greek philosophical traditions.
Oh yes.
Like, I mean, I know Augustine, but even at this early stage, do you think that's I know obviously Augustine, he is Platonist for a while, and then he uses it, but do you think even second century, like Serenus, you think it's already taking roots?
Yes. Oh, very much. Start with Plato was always the great father of Greek philosophy as well. Okay, so you got more or less four or five different big schools in Greece. This is not my area. Okay, the Stoics, the Cynics, the Platonists, the Aristotelians, as well, and so forth. But Plato was always the big one. Okay, at the back, and they tried to have some sort of link with Plato. So Bertrand Russell in the 20th century, in a quote that I love to quote, says that all philosophy is a footnote on Plato. Okay, which is actually quite true. And anyway, I'm about to go off the point there entirely. Right, and the Christians love Plato, right, because Plato has a brilliant idea of God as being the one, the really real, the true, the good, the beautiful. Okay, so everything that we believe about God still today, okay, is already there in Plato, right? And as people begin to discover that, the Christians appreciate it. Okay, so yeah, he's big for the Greeks, and the Christians take him up quite happily, too.
The particular reason why I say Christianity flourished for Neoplatonism, even though it's used in Christianity itself, does not flourish like the same. Mm-hmm. There's no real Neoplatonist. You know, the same way, say, like Plotinists are going around.
Say that again, sorry?
You know, the same way, like why he basically just shriveled away.
Yes.
The church.
Okay.
Flourished.
Okay. I wouldn't be too sure they shriveled away, right? So they had their moment of glory, and then no more after that. But you do get Christian writers such as Dionysius the Areopagite, right, in the 6th century or so, though nobody really knows when he wrote, who's very Neoplatonist. Okay, so Neoplatonism, for most of us, is a very interesting idea where God is one, and then when he sort of being falls off him, drips off him, okay, gets lower and lower until it comes to flesh. Right, but the spiritual climax is God himself. Okay, so Christianity could accept that and at the same time didn't. Also, I would say that Neoplatonism began to flourish around the time that Christianity began to become legal. Okay, so maybe Christianity nipped it in the bud in that sense. Right, because Neoplatonism is in some sense welcome to Christians, but in other senses because it denies the incarnation. So Arius, who the creed that we have every Sunday, was written against Arius. Arius basically has a Neoplatonist idea of God, and therefore Jesus must be lower than the Father. Okay, whereas Christians were saying, "Oh no, he's not." Right. So in that sense, Neoplatonism couldn't be used by Christians. And I know I'm thinking out in the hoof here, but maybe it's simply because Neoplatonism became important just as Christianity became strong.